Preston and Steve Fun Size.
All right, our next guest is here, and he is an adventurer taking some serious risks, but all in the name of science and exploration. I could go through all his accolades, but we're just going to talk to him. It's a National Geographic live event called View from Above, which will be at the Kimmel Center tonight at 8 o'clock. Please welcome astronaut Terry Burch to our program.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Nice to see you, Terry. Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
While you were walking up, we were saying, for a person like yourself who's been farther than most people ever, to get stuck in traffic must just be such a joy.
Welcome to Earth.
Exactly. So we're really stoked about having you here this morning. And just to give some people a little bit of background, Terry has not only been the pilot of the space shuttle, the Endeavor, STS-130, I think it was.
It was, yep.
And also, you have flown on the Soyuz spacecraft as well, commanded the International Space Station for 200 days, and also have performed spacewalks as well. Did I cover all that correctly?
I did, and and I spent my summers in York, PA. With
York, PA. Well, there you go.
Learned how to ski at Jack Frost. So,
So you're familiar with the area.
I'm from around here, yeah. From Maryland.
Oh, okay. Yes. Columbia?
Columbia, for the most part, yeah.
Okay.
Right. Oh, man. All right. Where does your trajectory into space start?
It started for me in kindergarten. I mean, literally, the first book I ever read was about space. I grew up with pictures of airplanes and rockets on the wall. So just when I was little, I wanted to do it. And
was there a particular person that you idolized? Were you like a Chuck Yeager, or was there somebody that you fixated on, or just the entire program in general?
So, of course, Neil and Buzz, on the moon. When I was a teenager, I read a book called The Right Stuff.
That's a masterpiece.
Amazing.
Love it.
And actually, the night before my first launch, me and the commander watched that movie.
It's so good.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, it ended up describing my career. But as a kid, it really motivated me. And also told me, I didn't know, I mean, I wasn't born in the royal family of astronauts. You know,
yeah.
I didn't know I was going to grow up to do this. So it was really an inspiration.
So the Air Force Academy, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so you get your chops there, and you move on to what is, I think, is an amazing, terrifying, super cool thing. You become a test pilot. You're testing out.
I did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've flown in 40 different plus aircraft. And with that, there's an inherent risk, obviously, as is depicted in The Right Stuff, when Yeager's asked to test out deals. Is just the overpowering, I'm going to keep going. Does that overpower fear, or is, you have to have fear, a little bit, some kind of fear, or do you?
You know, I must be a genetic defect. I think just as a pilot, I'm just not, I just don't get afraid in those situations.
Thank God for the defect, because if we didn't have people like you, we would never have... You know, we'd never have those leaps forward.
Right.
You know?
I think the most... I was on DC 101. You guys know the radio?
Sure. Yes.
They asked me the same question. Were you afraid of flying? And the airplanes and the rockets and stuff didn't make me scared. It was the fear of... Up that
well, we can't
screwing
say that on the air.
I don't know what you can say on the air.
Screwing up. Yeah. Astronaut. Potty mouth.
Ooh.
I love it. I wanted to ask you this. I mean, because clearly, you know, there's going to be fear because...
Bucket list check, by the way.
To curse on terrestrial.
Yeah, exactly.
In test piloting, and you guys take precautions, you have step-by-step procedures you're going to do as you're going through to make sure that these pieces of equipment operate the way they're intended to, and mm-hmm. you really don't know until you get up there and do it. Mm-hmm. But you do have steps that you take to ensure that you're doing it a bit at a time to see where you can take the next step. So I know you have those checks and balances in place. One of the questions I wanted to ask about flying experimental aircraft is, Steve and I have always pointed out that when they make cars and they show you the concept cars, you're like, man, I hope they make that one day.
Yeah.
And then they never do.
They
the
never...
coolest looking ones they never make.
Right.
Are there any aircraft where you're like, boy, I hope this one really makes it to the finish line?
Yeah, you know, there was a thing called the X-29, and the wings were actually pointed forward,
mm-hmm.
and you get less drag. And, like, if you're maneuvering a lot, you can just maneuver better that way.
I saw pictures really cool... of this thing. It looked cool, but it, what's why didn't
they built it? Well, I don't know why they built the test version of it.
Yeah.
People flew it, and then they never built it. And it's really hard to make the wings. There's a picture of it just got called up.
Yeah.
It's hard to make the wings on that thing because they have a tendency to want to break off, which is bad.
I guess it's structural.
Other than that, it's a great
structural integrity issue. I'm sorry, Preston.
The shuttle program, when I was a kid, you and I are the same age. You're 51. I turn 51 next week. when I was a kid... the Enterprise, I lived in St. Louis, so we went out to Lambert Field,
right?
And when they were flying it across country on that 747, they landed it there. So I went with my parents to see it. And I was telling these guys, as cool as that was, what I didn't know is these two T-38s came flying in first. I'm like, look at those things. Those are badass. And you were part of that program too, right? The T-38s?
Yes. So that's our main training that we do as astronauts. And it's actually the best. It's not learning the specifics of, you know, how to fly the shuttle or how to operate whatever system on the station, but it's real life, and it's training your brain to think ahead and not be afraid, and, you know, the decisions you make actually affect you. Like, you die if you don't make the right decision. If you're in a simulator, if you screw up, you just turn it off and walk out. But
you say, your fear is effing up, but that's the only fear. To be that systematic. You know, there's some in the right stuff. There are a number of situations that are depicted where they're showing, you know, you're basically sitting. You're sitting on a huge a bomb, you know, when the launch takes place. I wanted to ask you about. So you go up on the Soyuz. You traveled up to the International Space Station on the Soyuz, and you launched from the Cosmodrome,
right, in Baikonur,
right, which is now that is the largest space facility on Earth, is it not?
It's huge.
So give huge. Us your impressions of that and what that was like.
Oh, that was amazing. It was like going back into the 1960s. In fact, there's a lot of launch pads, but when I launched, we used the same one that Yuri Gagarin launched from.
Oh my God,
it's a mind blow, because you'd see footage. Now I'm older, but I remember seeing, you know, you'd see the footage. The Russians are up to this, and they would show the launches. And you're like, oh my God. And it created a sense of panic, but it's also very cool.
It was cool. I mean, the best part of my mission was being up there with the Russians. I was good friends with those guys. We still text each other, and we really had a good time. There was a lot of shit happening down here on Earth.
Yeah, stuff.
I'm wearing that button now.
Terry, you can't say those words. I know you're really smart and an astronaut, but and by the way, you share the distinction with Gilbert Gottfried of being bleeped two segments in a row.
So, oh, man.
F-word is out, S-word is out.
All right, I got it.
All right.
My bucket list keeps on getting checked off. So anyway, the experience of flying with those guys was amazing, and it was pretty cool to be from that same launch pad. I used to joke with them because they were in the Russian Air Force, and I would say, hey, the U.S. Air Force has a long tradition of being here in Baikonur. Yeah. You know, we're flying today. Back in the day, Gary Powers came over in his U-2, so, you know, the U.S. Air Force has been visiting here for a while.
Right, the U-2, the spy incident. Yeah, no, that's cool.
I wanted to ask about the shuttle versus the Soyuz program. Completely different.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, you have, a spacecraft that you can land on a runway and reuse. The Soyuz is more of a capsule-based spacecraft, which you do at an Earth landing as well.
Mm-hmm.
How piloting that? And now we know you were a pilot of the space shuttle, but you weren't the pilot of Soyuz, were you?
No.
Okay.
No.
So are you just kind of obviously you have duties to do, but at that point are you kind of along for the ride?
Oh yeah, landing. In fact, tonight I show a video of what a landing is like in the Soyuz.
I wanted to ask about that because the braking system that's used before you guys hit the ground, there's a big burst of of an engine.
What is that like?
Well, the Russians call it the soft landing rockets.
Yeah,
it should be called less of a crash landing rocket.
Right,
because that's what they say. It's like
driving into a telephone pole.
Oh my God!
Oh my God!
Really? Well, you'll see the video. Come watch the video.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
And with that, by the way, there'll be all sorts of the photographs that you've been taking and things. I just wanted to ask quickly, Casey, to jump in. There is a classic photo that I became aware of before I became aware of, you know, exactly who had taken it around the time of Leonard Nimoy's death. It's you doing the Vulcan peace sign, live long and prosper,
right,
through a window over Earth, over, I believe it was Boston, is Leonard Nimoy's birth city.
It is. It was amazing. In fact, that's one of the stories I tell. I use that picture. And we had a saying in the F-16, I'd rather be lucky than good.
Yeah.
And I did not plan that. I didn't have any time. I got an email that said, hey, Leonard Nimoy died. You know, Spock passed away. Can you do something? I got this picture of the sign and Earth, and I didn't know it, but in the background was Boston. So,
So that was happenstance.
Well, it was completely unplanned. Crazy. It was
no
just,
kidding.
Yeah.
All right, so the first
but it
time...
was really cool. It was a great tribute to Leonard.
Now, were you a Star Trek fan?
I was. Yeah. I mean, it was a little bit, it was before I was born, but yeah. I liked it.
And yeah.
I was more in the movies, right? The
Star
the
Wars?
Show was, no, well.
Oh, the Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean,
of
right.
course, Star Wars was huge when we were kids. But yeah, so the TV show was before, but, you know, they're still showing those old.
Reruns, oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know how to ask this question, so I'm just going to say it this way.
Will we need the button?
You will not need the button.
We got it.
But is there anything you. Is there anything you can say or that you have said to flat earthers?
Yes. So, you know, I went to England this one time and I was on the British news and they wanted to talk about flat earth. And I'm
with
like,
Piers Morgan, gotta, yeah?
With Piers Morgan,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
You guys got to be, you're killing me. This guy out in Seattle wanted to build a rocket to climb up to 1,000 feet.
What? 1,000 feet?
To prove that the earth was, I'm like, okay. So if the earth was flat and when I launched to the east going 17,000 miles an hour, I'd still be flying off to the east. You know, thankfully it's not. It's round, and I came back around and landed. So, yeah, you know.
But there's no – Preston and I were talking about this. I think it's more – there is more of a need to be part of a group than to actually have it predicated on any real – science or
in other words, there's no science. I think it's a way to get Twitter followers or something.
Maybe that's it. Yeah. Or and if they believe that, you know, they're if they want to believe that, that's their deal. But there is, I mean, you have been there, you know, and they're, you know, I just don't get it. I just don't get. But they explain it, you know, and it is still. Does it boggle you your mind that it's still a fairly pervasive perception?
I think. It's just a way to get, like, if you're a rapper or something, and you
get some press.
It gets you some press.
Yeah,
you
know, maybe that's it.
It does, but I believe some people believe it, and it's just, it blows me away because the amount of man hours, people, engineering, science, people who have died, and all these other things that have happened for decades aren't enough proof for you.
Well, I think it speaks to a bigger issue in that, okay, flat earth's one thing, but there's lots of things. If somebody says something, there will be a group of people that believe them.
Right.
So it's really important to like have policy and everything based in fact and science,
and also it's
craziness.
It's an incumbent on all of us to do our due diligence and do our do your own investigation.
Don't just believe what you hear.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Look into it.
And by the way, that comment I made was not just about flat earthers, about people who deny that the space program is legitimate.
The landing on the moon.
Or just going into space, period.
So I have to tell you, because I was telling Preston, I got the Oculus, the VR thing. And so I purchased a program from NASA that's a simulation of the Apollo 11, the landing on the moon and the whole thing. And it's accompanied with audio. And I guess I'm supposed to be Neil Armstrong and the lab and the whole thing. I'm sitting on my couch and I'm sweating bullets. You know, you were up there. You know, as you say, and you're cool as a cucumber. But you had an incident occur. I think it was an alarm went off aboard the space station, and it was explain what happened. Was it 20?
Oh yeah. So I wrote 15? An entire chapter.
Yeah.
My book View from Above, chapter 5 is about this. The station has 3 different emergencies that we practice for: fire, which there's false alarms that happen. An air leak, which occasionally there's a false alarm, but the third is an ammonia leak. Ammonia is the coolant, and ammonia is super deadly.
Like, yeah.
They tell you if you smell it, you don't have to worry about it because you're going to die. It's like not good.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's comforting.
So, and that alarm had never gone off ever in the history of the station. So one day it went off, and long story short, I don't want to give it away because this is big part of my talk tonight. But the main part about it wasn't the emergency. It was that we had to hang out on the Russian segment, and in the middle of all this mess with Russia, the deputy prime minister called up and said, hey, you can stay as long as you want. We'll work together to get through this. So it was a great story of international cooperation.
That's cool. So you can hear about that tonight.
You can.
Okay. But it's so to us, to, you know, when we see the fuel gauge come on in our cars and we start getting nervous, you know, it is a context we can scarcely comprehend.
That's why the T-38s are so good for astronaut training, because when the fuel gauge comes on that, you can't just, like, pull over and stop. You have to find a runway to land on.
Yeah.
And I've got all my best scary stories were in airplanes. And, you know, those are
far more
to deal with those. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, space, there were some, too, but most of them were in F-16s or T-38s.
I have spacecraft questions and aircraft questions. Somebody texts in, good question. Were you ever, and I don't think so, I think that by the time you got into the pilot program, they weren't around anymore. SR-71 Blackbird, was that already retired by the time you were a pilot?
I think that thing retired like a year or two after I got in, so I was too young for
okay,
that.
Okay, all right.
Cool airplane.
How about in spacecraft, liftoff and getting into low Earth orbit or... returning to Earth,
yes.
What is more exciting slash fun? Obviously, you've got things to concentrate on, but I can imagine you don't let the experience get past you.
Yeah, the launching is incredible. The sound, the noise, the shaking, all that. But the test pilot in me, like, you got to go from 0 to 17,000 miles an hour, which is a big deal. But you got to go from 17,000 to zero, and the test pilot in me. I think I thought that was even a bigger deal. Wow. It's not as flashy, so to speak, but it's hard to do. And you'll see pictures tonight. Looking out the window, it's orange and pink, and the flashing coming back in the Soyuz. The shuttle was like an airliner. I mean, it's kind of gentle. The G forces are not that big. The Soyuz is more like riding a bowling ball, and that thing was like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. It was crazy.
You no said kidding. When you first saw the Earth, you said it was as if you had lived your life in from space. You'd lived your life in black and white, and finally saw what color was.
Right,
and the blues you'd never seen before.
Right.
Do you get emotional?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to see, like, you're not on the planet anymore.
Yeah.
You're in space and there's Earth down there, you know. And for me, it was emotional. But I had to fly the shuttle, so it was like, I can't believe what I'm seeing. All right, back to, you know, turn the hydraulic pumps off.
When I'm driving, you know, like we were driving up Mount Washington.
Right.
And, like, I'm driving, right? It's a scary road, so I have to pay attention. Everybody else gets
to see. And
then
you hit zero Gs.
Right. Yeah.
And everybody gets to see.
Exactly. Yes.
When you do pierce the envelope of space for the first time, I assume you did it as a regular pilot, correct? I mean, you sort of touch the edge of, I mean.
Oh, on an F-16?
Yeah, yeah.
50,000 feet as high as that went, and
okay.
That's kind of high. It's a little bit different, but you're not quite
right. Not black. Quite there. Right. Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
It's on the way.
Okay. And are you so in the moment that you can't perceive? You know, is it a snapshot in your mind? I mean, you know, how does it record in your mind?
I remember distinctly a couple things, and the whole chapter one is about the 8.5 minute launch. I remember seeing the east coast of the U.S.
Yeah.
The shuttle launches upside down, and then it rolled heads up to point the antennas at the satellite. And you don't know if it's going to roll left or right. So if it rolls one direction, the commander, the guy in the left seat, gets to see Earth. And if it rolls the other direction, the guy in the right seat. And luckily, again, I'd rather be lucky than good, it decided to roll. So I saw the first view of Earth was of the east coast at nighttime. And it was like, wow. And, of course, I'm smashed in my seat and the rockets are burning. And
yeah.
And I didn't know, but there was no doubt. Like, okay, there's Baltimore, Washington. There's Philly. There's New York. You could see it all only in a few seconds. And then it was back to flying the shuttle.
It's so amazing.
That was my first view.
If you're tuning in, astronaut Terry Virts is here. National Geographic Live. Terry Virts' view from above is tonight at the Kimmel Center. If you'd like to go, tickets just start at $31. You can get them at KimmelCenter.com.
Terry, do you have Apple TV?
I do. In fact, I got a story about that.
Okay. The reason I ask is that when it goes to the screensaver,
uh-huh.
they have several shots from space looking down on the Earth.
They do.
Were you involved in it? Well, say what you were going to say, and then I'll ask my question.
Helped out on that project, yeah.
Okay.
It happened after I landed. It just came out a few months ago.
Yeah.
I
find it mesmerizing. I like playing a little game in my head of figuring out where it is on the planet.
Yes.
And then, there's one that goes down, for example, the coast of California.
Uh-huh.
And it starts up near San Francisco, and then before you know it, you're in, like, Costa Rica. You've gone past the Baja. And
yes.
It's so fast. Is that at all what it's like for you while traveling in space, seeing landforms?
That shot took us months to get, by the way. With the sunlight reflecting, you see the little lakes
yes.
in Central California. That shot took a long time. So they slowed it down to nearly real time. It's not exact, but it's kind of like that. I mean, you're going 5 miles a second. So,
it only takes a second.
It takes like minutes to fly across America.
And
you know,
what's the camera equipment you use to get those shots?
Those shots were shot on Nikon still cameras, D5s, I think. It's the big professional, you know, at the Super Bowl and baseball games.
Yeah,
the
cameras, yeah.
It's the Nikon version of that. The movie, the IMAX movie I shot, Beautiful Planet, was filmed on Canon, but they're both. So they do still, either 2 or 4 frames a second, still shots, and then the software guys on the ground process that into a movie.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it's really cool to watch.
These things are just. I do this. This is what's on my house at home. I turn it on, put on some music, and while I'm working, you know, that's going by. If you touch the remote, it'll tell you where it is.
Yes,
the little thing comes up. Yeah,
I have an ISS remote or app on my phone that alerts me when it's flying overboard.
Oh yeah,
or flying overhead. I should say the International Space Station. And my family and I still get the biggest joy. We've seen it. I don't know how many times.
Yeah,
but it moves so fast. You see it with the naked eye, and it's just this solitary light that does not blink or change, it just zips across the sky. Yeah. It's incredible how fast that's going.
Yeah. Well, you know. Like I said, 5 miles a second.
Yeah. Do you know who's on there right now? So, like, when it flies over, like, oh, there goes Bob.
Yeah. David Saint-Jacques is a Canadian guy, and Anne McClain is the American. There's a smaller crew. The next group of three go up soon, but, yeah.
We had Astro Nicole. What is her name? Nicole
Stott?
Yes. We had her in studio a little while back.
Uh-huh.
It's a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, awesome.
I could talk to you guys all day, every day. But I was given some hope, and it was never able to happen. But I would love for us to be able to actually talk to somebody in the space station while they're in the space station. Do you guys do that? I know that you've talked to classrooms and stuff like that. But
yeah, I think every week there's a certain number of media events. You know, the NASA PAO people get X number of that. So you can do it.
How about 2 for Tuesday? Would they go for that?
I think it'd be good. You won't have to worry about hitting the button. Those guys.
I wanted to ask where you see the space program going, the American space program. Obviously, it's a world collaboration for some of the nations around the world. But what do you see not too distant future of what's going to be taking place.
So when I look at the overall space program, I think we're at the end of the beginning. And I mean that in a good way. And at the beginning of the space program was Apollo and Shuttle and the Soyuz.
Gemini.
And these big government programs, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we're at the end of that phase, I hope, in that companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and the private sector, we have, because of the internet, we have these billionaires who can actually fund it at a good, you know, Jeff Bezos has some spare change in his account.
Yeah.
And they're just so much more innovative. They get stuff done so much faster.
The private sector
does.
Okay. Right? And it's a fascinating thing to see it happen. And to do it when Preston and I nearly died when we saw a rocket land vertically.
Yeah, the SpaceX.
It's one of my slides tonight. I show that slide.
It's just unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, where do you see in my lifetime this going? Assuming I live to 80.
Yeah. I hope we go to Mars. I've written some op-eds about this. I think the moon is a good first step. We were talking about being a test pilot. So the first thing you learn is about being a test pilot is you should do a build-up approach.
Yeah.
You shouldn't just start. And we didn't start with Apollo. We started with Mercury and then Gemini and then Apollo. Mm-hmm. So I think the moon will kind of be like a Gemini in the big scheme.
Like
of things.
A staging launch area from the moon. Are we going to have a moon base?
Jeff Bezos wants to.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and he's writing $1 billion a year of his own personal checks to, you know, make that happen. And I think to have a moon base, you'll have to be able to find water on the moon, which is, water's there, but can you get to it? That's a tough thing to do. But I don't know. We'll see. Let them try and see if it works.
And Mars viable?
Mars is viable. We need to get a better rocket system that'll get us there and back quicker.
Yeah.
The normal rockets that we have now is about a 3-year round trip. And if you use nuclear-powered engines, you can get there and back in 1 year. And so personally, I think 3 years, that's a lot of food and underwear to pack.
Yeah, it is.
Have they figured out the radiation protection issues?
They figured it out. It's there and it's bad. So that's another reason to go 1 year, right? You can... water's a good protection. This is one of my things I'll talk about tonight. Water is lead is the best, but at hundreds of thousands of dollars a pound,
weighs too much. Yeah,
but you have to have water anyway. So you just take your water and surround the crew. You know,
really,
instead of metal, you put little water bladders, and that helps.
So how about water and lead, like the water from Flint, Michigan?
Yes.
You should.
Brilliant.
That's amazing.
Brilliant.
You should start a contract. You could be a subcontractor of Boeing. Build this thing. Yeah. Start a company.
When Commander Hadfield, they did a documentary on his year in space, right?
Hadfield, you mean Scott Kelly?
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah. Kelly.
It was Kelly.
He flew with me, yeah.
So you're in that documentary.
With the time... Well, because Time did one. I'm in that one.
Well, specifically I want to ask about, because you guys got a, you got rations sent up to you.
Yeah.
And there was talk about the smell of space when you were opening up the capsule.
Yeah.
And what does space smell like?
I was so interested in that. So
if you tell him Old Spice, he's going to be thrilled.
Axe. Remember that? Nothing beats an astronaut.
Axe body spray.
They still have it.
So the when you either do a spacewalk or you open the hatch because that spaceship was just out in space, there is a very unique, I've never smelled it before, and to me, it was like an electrical, musty ozone. If you had those old Lionel trains.
And yes. Oh, yeah.
They're like sparking.
I know what you're talking about.
There's some smell.
I like that smell.
That comes with electricity, and that's just what it smells
like. It's a nostalgic smell. For me, it smells
like the 1950s.
Yeah, yeah.
But is there something to be studied there with just the smell? Does that tell you something about...
Well, so space itself, there's nothing there, so you're not actually smelling that, but I think you're smelling the effect of this crazy temperature and radiation and pressure on the metal and on the... There's this fabric, it's called MLI, and it's like a thermal protection fabric that we have. So anyway, it's like what you're smelling is the effects of space on this normal material.
Hmm. Did you say you flew with Scott Kelly?
I did, yeah.
Okay, because my son was he's in elementary school now, but he was in preschool, and he said something to me once about Scott Kelly, and I go, who's Scott Kelly?
Who's Scott Kelly?
He goes, you don't know who Scott Kelly is, Mom? I'm like, no. He goes, he's an astronaut. And I was like, oh, and that's how I learned who Scott Kelly
who's Scott
was.
Kelly was from your preschooler.
From my preschooler. Yeah. And he got so Scott. Into rockets and space and all of that year. Yeah.
That's awesome. I'll tell Scott. He'll be happy.
For the presentation tonight and everything. So all of these stories, you know, pictures, the whole thing. Video.
It's over an hour. Lots of pictures. Some of my, photo. I took a lot of pictures when I was in space. Some video. Yeah. And then words.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, words. Well, you're good at words. Words. Some of them dirty.
Yeah.
This is true.
There won't be any of those. Maybe unless they can bleep me out on stage.
You know, with the International Space Station, and I know that regularly there are experiments of sorts that are going on.
Oh, yeah.
And that takes up a good portion of your time when you're working up there. What has been the fruit of those labors that we may not be familiar with? Have there been some medications? Have there been... engineering things that we found out that we didn't know because of these experiments that have been taking place?
So that's a great question. And the way science works nowadays, it's not like Newton, gravity falls and he discovers gravity. Well, that all the easy stuff has been figured out. So the science, especially the biology we're doing, is like one piece of a 100-piece puzzle. And so and a lot of what we do goes back to the drug companies. I did some stuff for some big pharma companies on E. coli vaccinations, and so they can use that to make better vaccinations for people on Earth. There's some cancer medicines that have been worked on. Astronomy, where there's this machine that's trying to figure out what the universe is made of, is how much dark matter and dark energy is out there,
which is another whole mind-blowing concept.
We don't even know what the universe is made of. It's unbelievable. And the station is trying to do that. So
I wanted to ask,
because I'm sorry to interrupt, to piggyback on that. I'm curious as to, with the private sector getting involved the way that it is that someday we will see floating labs. Pfizer has a lab to make a better Viagra or whatever it may be.
Space boners.
In space. Because that's kind of where I see all of this eventually maybe going to, is that we have these facilities that are in space that are private, and they're used for production and manufacturing of certain things you can't do in gravity environments,
right,
or in that need to be done in vacuums and so on.
SpaceX and Blue Origin are building the rockets and capsules. There's a guy named Bigelow that's building private space stations for that exact thing.
It's a mind blower.
The station's good for research, but it's not manufacturing. That's not what it's for.
I wanted to ask you, Terry, about the long-term effects of being in a weightless condition. And I know that there are different devices and exercise devices where you can retain some of your muscle and bone density and things of that nature. But how effective is that when you return to Earth? How reduced were your capabilities?
So bone density loss is a big thing. And after 200 days, they gave me 2.5 hours of exercise every day. I lost 0.0% of my bone density. So basically, by lifting weights and running on a treadmill
in the station, here,
over half a year in space, when I got back to Earth, I had lost 0% of my bone density. The week I got back, I did 20 pull-ups. I was in good. It was like being on a health 2.5 hours
okay.
a day. It was like being at a health spa.
Wow.
In some ways.
Wow. Yeah.
For me, the big problem was radiation, because that can lead to cancer, and you kind of just have to wait and see what cancer you get.
What are your shifts like on the ISS?
So there's not, it's not like somebody's awake all time. Everybody wakes up in the morning and goes to bed at night. If the clock is GMT, so it's London time.
Yeah.
And there's a conference call usually about 7:30 in the morning.
We have one at 6, by the way.
Same thing.
Yeah.
A lot less stressful.
We talk to Moscow and Houston and all the different control centers, and then we go to work, do science. The reason we were there is to do science or maintenance or cargo ship comes or get ready for a spacewalk or do interviews with the local rock and roll station or whatever, whatever we're doing. That's, you know, and then at the end of the day, we have another conference, and then that's when I would start to do my pictures and film this IMAX movie, film the whole thing in my spare time. NASA didn't give me any time to film it. So it's a pretty busy day, but it's structured, but every day is different because you have to do everything.
NASA needs, I mean, listen, I've been a massive fan of NASA in the early days. I mean, the whole thing, but it is important. A film like that, an IMAX film.
Yeah.
Generates such zeal and such interest, and they, you know, they I think they need to understand more the impact of that. I think they're getting better at understanding the importance of creating fans of this.
Of all the stuff I did, I think Beautiful Planet was the most important one. I went to the Air and Space Museum. I did a nude scene in there. There's a scene like, how do you wash in space? So there's a picture, there's a scene of me. So I got paid twice what my crewmates did.
That's great.
Two times zero to do that scene. Anyway, when I went to the Air and Space Museum, they told me that 1 million people are going to see that movie. It'll be there for a decade or
wow.
Right. And I'm like, that's of all these science experiments I did, which are important. No one knows about them, but 1 million people are going to see them.
Are going to be influenced. Yeah. Awesome.
Speaking of experiments, the Chinese just landed on the dark side of the moon.
Yes.
And they are a growing cotton plant in the lunar module. Is that right?
I just saw that. Yeah, they have the plant growing. That was pretty impressive.
It's really
the far side of the moon. No one's ever landed there. Of course, we landed on the near side, the side you can see. But that was pretty impressive.
And this is the first time anything's ever been grown in space like this? Or, I'm sorry, on the moon like this?
I think on the moon, I don't know if the Apollo guys brought anything or not. I think that's the first time that's happened on the moon.
Wow. I love it. Going back to movies, of Hollywood films, what would you rank? And obviously the right stuff is going to be one of the top
right
or number one.
Yeah.
What would you put as like a top five, maybe, if you can think of that?
So the right stuff is the best. Apollo 13 is the best. That's a great movie. And it's filmed, it's real humans. They filmed it in the Vomit Comet, that airplane.
Yeah.
So all the scenes are 20 seconds or less, and it's real. It's not computer graphics.
Mm-hmm. Did you like The Martian?
I love The Martian, yeah.
And book's phenomenal, too.
Yeah, I liked 2001 was great. I watched that when I was in space.
Oh, yeah. So it's funny because that, you know, you're in space watching a projection of what space would be
like. We watched Gravity, too, which is pretty cool. I know the filmmaker. Interstellar, I like that.
Yeah.
It's a father-daughter story, which I love. I got a daughter. So.
But talking about depicting the length of time, the time that, you know, things would need to train. You talk about a 3-year trip to Mars, and they deal with the extremes of that sort of deep space, you know, journey and how much it would take.
Yeah, the Martian.
Yeah.
The science about what to do, you know, how to live on Mars was really interesting and pretty good. Now, the big giant Mars ship appeared and took them to Mars, and That's a minor detail. Like we don't have that Mars
you don't
ship.
Have that yet?
Yeah, right.
Right.
So, right. But once he was on Mars, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So when you're in space at night,
right?
Okay. And by at night, I mean you're on the opposite side of the Earth as
the
sun.
Yep.
Are the stars like crazier than you've ever seen? Yeah. Or they are?
You'll see that tonight. And you made a great distinction because night GMT. We could be in the sunlight or nighttime. So you go around the Earth every hour and a half. So you have 16 sunrises and sunsets a day. And your body doesn't work on that clock. So that's a good distinction. But when you look at, and I was doing a talk with Chris Hadfield one time, and he said, oh, you can't see stars at night. And I was like, what space station were you on? If you turn the lights off and you let your eyes adjust, you can't, there's more stars you can imagine. I mean, the whole sky is filled.
Yeah, because the most I've ever seen was, I camped in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And there was no moon.
Right.
So
that's amazing.
That was the most I had ever seen. Right. And I just wasn't sure that if you were on the opposite side of Earth, if you would see.
Even more. Like, I know the basic constellations. I'm not an expert, but, you know, I know Orion and the Big Dipper and... And I could never recognize a constellation in space.
No
kidding.
There's just
so many stars.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't believe there's nobody that has to watch over things while you sleep.
While they on the ground, the mission control. There's people 24/7.
There's Gus, the security guard.
Yeah.
Can they wake you if they need to get to you?
When that alarm goes off, there's no doubt that something is significant is happening. Yeah.
Hey, how about seeing other planets with the naked eye?
So,
more luminous than here?
So I could see planets. Of course, Mars is red.
Yeah.
And Jupiter and Saturn are kind of yellow, orangish. They're easy. Venus is super bright. One planet I saw that I think most people on Earth have either never seen or don't know it is Mercury. It's right next to the sun.
Yeah.
If there's trees... You don't see it because it's always right on the horizon, right next to the sun. And it's just something I think most people never notice on Earth. In space, I saw it a bunch.
I have a pretty kick-ass telescope.
Oh, yeah.
And it has sun filters. Would I be able to see Mercury?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You can see it with your naked eye if you don't have trees or buildings and you know what you're looking for.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's always when it's farthest from the sun, perpendicular, it's still really close to the sun.
Okay.
So you only see it in the morning and evenings.
All right. I'm going to have to
We have to have you back.
Yeah. Most definitely. Yeah.
For your next coffee table book and IMAX film.
Yes. it's going to be fascinating tonight. Terry is going to be at the Kimmel Center, which is a wonderful place in and of itself, but showing View from Above, or his show will be there tonight. And it's through National Geographic Live. Which is wonderful. We could spend forever talking to you, but we've used up our dump button for the amount of times that you've cursed today, so you've hit your allotment. But Terry, it's an honor to meet you. Thank you so much for coming by here. This
was great. It's good to be in Philly.
Appreciate it. Terry Virts, guys.
Yeah!
Go see him tonight at the Kimmel Center. We'll take a break and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Want more Preston and Steve? Get the whole show podcast or Bizarre Files at PrestonandSteve.com.
StageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.